This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. This is Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. The future of the world as we know it will change once our fossil fuel inheritance is spent. But are we all doing enough to develop a replacement energy infrastructure for when it does happen? Joining me now to discuss this is Rob Dietz. He's the program director at the Post Carbon Institute, and he was also the lead author of Enough is Enough, a book on steady state economics. Rob joins me on the line from the US to also discuss practical and concrete things we can do to support the transition to a sustainable economy, particularly in the current economic and political climate. Hi, Rob. How are you today?
Oh, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on the program, Juliet.
So, Rob, you know, he promised to do it and he did it. President Trump, he pulled out of the Paris Agreement earlier this month, in early June, actually. Were you surprised?
No, wasn't surprised. You know, he said he was going to do it. He kind of had this drama leading up to it where he said, will I or won't I?
Yeah.
It seemed to me pretty clear that he was going to. And, you know, I thought one of the most unusual things was that his Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, who was the former head of Exxon, was in favor of staying in. That was kind of a surprise. But I thought he was going to do it. And I have to say, I feel it's a shame, it's a travesty that the United States, you know, the country, my country, and the country that has contributed, you know, a lot of CO2 to the atmosphere, has, you know, it feels like we're shirking our responsibilities. But I do think there's an upside in it. And, you know, it's that a lot of people are rallying now that decision has been made. And so you see communities, cities, even states that are saying, well, it doesn't really matter what they're saying at the national level. We're going to comply with the treaty, and we're going to do what's right. We believe the science. We want to take action. So that's at least encouraging, you know, But it doesn't just mean that, you know, it's a, you know, really a pull out and nobody's going to do anything here.
I think because not just governors of cities, but also, you know, big companies like the Googles of the world, Amazon and all that, they have, you know, promised to stay on course, you know, and to try and limit whatever they can in terms of greenhouse gas emissions and things like that. Am I right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's part of that resistance. You know, a lot of people here are really disappointed. Like I said, they believe the science. They want to take action. I mean, a lot of people are feeling this in their bones, right? That you know, this is a question of the sustainability of our civilization, and, you know, that the health of our ecosystems. You know, this is base level stuff. And, you know, if we blow it, you know, what are we leaving for future generations? And so, you know, you think of corporations as looking only as far as the next quarter of a year, and, you know, completely run by profit. But, you know, the corporations have a lot of caring people that work within their walls, and, you know, the people are saying, hey, we need to do something about this. So that, to me, that's the encouraging part. But boy, we got to get our politics straight.
You know, speaking of politics, actually, I was reading an article in Forbes which said that I think 22 Republican senators actually sent President Trump a letter. This was sometime in, I think, end of May, and strongly encouraging to make a clean break from the Paris Agreement, because apparently if he didn't, his administration's ability to fulfill its goal in rescinding the Clean Power Plan would be at risk. Can you tell us about the Clean Power Plan? I think that was one of Obama's seminal climate rules for existing power plants. Am I right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not an expert on it, but my understanding is that, you know, Obama put in an executive order where the idea is to make a switch over time from, you know, from coal and from greenhouse gas emitting power plants to renewable energy, and, you know, kind of on a long-term schedule. And, you know, that doesn't sit well with Trump coming into office saying we're gonna reboot coal, we're gonna get the mines going, we're gonna get the coal power plants fired up. And so, you know, he you know, basically wanted to do away with that executive order. And you know, that was one of the first things that he did coming into office.
And, you know, he mentioned many other reasons for pulling out. You know, he said it was just a bad deal for the U.S. You know, he said it would only lead to minuscule climate benefits, you know, but he did also say he'd be willing to sign back up if the price was right. I mean, what did you think, you know, because there was a long speech, right, about all the reasons. How did you feel or react to all those things that he, all the so-called facts that he brought up to back up his decision?
Well, I guess to answer very honestly, I didn't react well. But, you know, I would say if all that's true and you're pulling out, then what are you proposing? Mm-hmm. You know, if you are stating that, you know, we need to do something about climate change, but you're just pulling out of the only agreement that we're in, you know, what do you propose instead? You know, there's not any, you know, any dialogue coming from the administration about how to get out of the predicament we're in. There's just a return to, you know, to what I would think of as 20th century thinking, that it's all big business, it's all jobs only without considering any consequence. And, you know, it doesn't really make any sense. I mean, even the jobs issue, there are a lot more jobs now in renewable energy than in coal. So why are we talking about reopening the mines? You know, and it doesn't seem like that's exactly the healthiest or best job. I mean, I feel for towns that were based on mining, and that was basically the sole source of their income. But, you know, we need to evolve. We need to make sure that people living in those places have job opportunities that actually have a future, not some hollow promise to return to something that isn't going to happen.
Yeah, some people likened it to like, okay, I used to use a Motorola and that served me well back then, so I'm going to go back to using that even though there's so many other options now, better options out there.
Yeah, you know, I'm surprised Trump didn't come in talking about returning to horses and buggies for transportation. I mean, it just, you know, the horse and buggy industry would have been really happy. And, yeah, it's pretty silly, you know, that he promised that. But, you know, a lot of people in the U.S., you know, there's been a problem with equity and with job opportunities. I mean, we've had more and more of the wealth flowing to the top, and there are a lot of people who are hurting. So, you know, I think they're susceptible to that kind of rhetoric and those kinds of promises, even though in the end they're going to turn out to be empty.
Also during his speech, he kind of, well, I suppose, demonized countries like China and India, for example. And I think it's quite obvious that the Chinese economy actually is already transitioning from a reliance on manufacturing to prioritizing innovation. And I think a lot of people are actually saying that America is actually missing out on a golden economic opportunity that green energy presents. You know, it's likely to be lost. Would you agree with that thought?
I guess to some extent. I mean, I do think you see China taking a leadership role in you know, trying to produce the solar energy infrastructure.
Yeah.
But it's not like the U.S. is completely missing the boat either. I mean, just because the president says these things, it doesn't put a stop to people working at lower levels of government, and it certainly doesn't put a stop to people in business doing what they're going to do. I mean, a lot of people recognize that, you know, we're not going to be building a bunch of coal power plants. we're going to have to find ways to power our society, our communities, our economies with renewable energy. And so, you know, there's renewable energy is certainly growing in the United States as well.
Most of the people that I spoke to, actually, I think I mentioned to you, I spoke to the EU ambassador to Malaysia, and I spoke to one of the chief negotiators for the like-minded developing countries, and nobody seemed too perturbed by Trump's decision. How do you think his decision will actually affect developing countries like Malaysia, for example?
Because I mean, his decision to pull out of the
Paris Agreement. Yeah, because you know, there's also the thing like the climate fund, for example. So I think that means that the U.S. won't have to contribute to it because if you pull out of the agreement, right? Do you think that's going to have a very adverse reaction, especially for developing countries?
I mean, it could have an effect, right? I mean, if you are throwing money at a problem, can help, but you know, it's not like money is really the answer here. For solving, if you can call it that, for you know, at least making positive change in our climate dilemma, it's really about changing what we're doing. You know, yes, technology can help, and And there are a lot of things coming down the pipeline. Well, maybe that's the wrong word, pipeline. That's more affiliated with oil. But there are things that are happening on the technological front that are certainly good. You know, as we make better batteries, for example, and the ability to store electricity more effectively. But it's not like that's all we have to do. We really have to get a handle on how much energy we're using. You know, we've got to find ways to run our daily lives and our economies in much more powered down, you know, much more effective ways. And I'm not sure that the U.S. pulling out prevents anybody from making strides in that direction. I would far rather the U.S. be in, and that we're all in solidarity. I mean, this is a global problem, and we all need to work together on it. And you know, we need unprecedented levels of cooperation, not kind of a, we're going to go our own way and we're going to blame you while we head down our own way. I don't like to see that. I do, you know, you would probably have a better idea than I do, but I think if I were living in another country, I'd kind of be thinking, that guy's not going to last, you know, and the United States is a large, diverse country with lots of different opinions, and it's messy sometimes, but, you know, hopefully we'll muddle our way back to what I think of as the logical approach. We believe the science, we look over our policy options, try to pick the best ones that actually respect the limits to economic growth, that understand our economic, ecological crises, and put us on the track to sustainability.
You know, one of the things that the Paris Agreement advocates assert that, you know, that even though President Trump decided to pull out the agreement, we will face an inevitable transition to a multitude of new low-carbon energy technologies, you know, that will consign hydrocarbons, oil, natural gas, coal, you know, those sorts of things to history's dust heap. Mm-hmm. But basically what we need to do is birth the new energy future and the right incentives, which Paris actually provides. Do you think then the only way to meet, aspirational carbon emission reductions is to replace hydrocarbons?
Yeah, I mean, one way or another, the hydrocarbon era is going to end, right? I mean, it's mm-hmm. a non-renewable resource. So yeah. We, at some point, we'll stop digging up fossil fuels. But, you know, the limit that we're hitting faster than the end of the supply is the ability for the climate to absorb, you know, the rising levels of CO2 and other greenhouse gases. So yeah. We really need to stop before we burn it all. But yeah, I mean, one way or the other, it's coming to an end. And I totally think that we need to make that transition to the renewable energy economy. We need to do it with as much urgency as we can. So certainly incentives to change and you know, restructuring things like how we transport ourselves and our goods, how we how we build our cities, how we grow food. All these kinds of things are going to need large and fundamental changes as we go forward. And I think we're seeing that as we see ways that work well, that reduce our footprint, but, you know, help people meet their needs. You know, those models can be reproduced from community to community. So, you know, it's at least an exciting time in, you know, on that front.
Joining me today from the US is Rob Dietz. He's the program director at the Post Carbon Institute, and he was also the lead author of Enough is Enough, a book on steady state economics. And we were discussing Trump's decision to pull out of the Paris Agreement. And coming after this quick break, we'll discuss more about the Post Carbon Institute and ways we can all transition into a post carbon world. You are listening to Earth Matters on the Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. This is Earth Matters on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Julia Jacobs. Joining me on the line from the US is Rob Dietz. He's the program director at the Post Carbon Institute, and he was also the lead author of Enough is Enough, a book on steady state economics. So just before the break, we were discussing the possible need to replace hydrocarbons to meet aspirational carbon emissions, which actually brings me to my next question, actually, because now you are working with the Post Carbon Institute. I guess that's something to do with what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
Could you tell me a bit about what the organization's mission is?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. The broad vision is that we envision a world of resilient communities with localized economies that thrive within ecological bounds. You know, so I mean, there's a lot to unpack there, but But basically, with the converging crises, you know, we've got energy that, you know, we know we can't keep burning fossil fuels, and we know we're not going to have this what has been historically an incredibly cheap and powerful energy supply. We also know that we have an overshoot problem. We have too many people consuming too much stuff on the planet right now. You know, mm-hmm. things like ecological footprint analysis tell us that we're consuming, you know, 1.5 times what the Earth can regenerate over the course of a year. So with things like that, you know, these crises, I guess another one to point out is the biodiversity crisis. You know, yeah. the science is telling us we're in the sixth mass extinction, and that's caused by our, you know, disruption of habitat and a number of other things that people are doing to cause that problem. So with those crises, what is the most positive thing that we can do? And we're working toward building community resilience. You know, you can't change the momentum overnight, but the idea is that we work within our own communities, figure out what would make our communities more resilient, what would keep them from, you know, where an external shock would basically change our communities in ways that we can't even conceive of. So, you know, we're all about telling the truth about the crises that we face, and then working to inform people about ideas at the community level for building resilience.
And how exactly do you go about doing that? Especially, you know, going out to the, I think getting community buy-in is probably one of the most important things in this fight.
Yeah.
How do you actually go about doing that?
Yeah, we're mostly a think tank, so we try to get information to people. So, for example, we've got a Think Resilience course that's taught by Richard Heinberg, who is this. He's just a wonderful teacher, philosopher, journalist, scientist. You know, just a lot of different hats that he wears, and he's got this online course that makes people aware of the crises that we're facing, both, you know, from environmental to economic to, and does this with a really wonderful historic overview. You know, how did we get to this place that we're in? Mm-hmm. And then moves on to the idea of building communities' resilience, which is, you know, all about analyzing how does your community operate? What resources does it need? Where does it get its, you know, what are the material flows coming in? And how might you change that to make your community more able to deal with what's coming, with, mm-hmm. you know, with climate change, with a powered down society. So we do things like that. We put out a lot of information, resources, books. We've got a book called The Community Resilience Reader, which is compiling some of the best essays on how to build community resilience. So yeah, we do a lot of those kinds of things, and, you know, speaking engagements and just trying to get information to the public and to policymakers that, you know, that will help them deal with these crises that are coming.
So, I mean, in a very, I suppose, base level, then what does a post-carbon future actually look like to somebody like me, just here in Malaysia, to me and my family, for example?
Yeah, well, I think on the, you know, people often think, well, that's going to be a lot of sacrifice.
Yeah.
And I guess in some sense it might, right? Like you know, it might mean that we drive less, you know, that we're transporting goods and services less distance, you know, you know, there's always a flip side to that, you know, like driving less also means less traffic, you know, it might mean changing the infrastructure. You know, that's a hard thing because we've built an infrastructure that's based on fossil fuels.
Yeah.
But I'm excited about the possibility of a more human scale infrastructure. You know, like I love places that are car free, actually. You know, mm-hmm. There's not that many of them, it seems, you know, at least in urban environments anymore. But those places, they have a you know, more of an intimate feel, and it kind of invites community. You know, you can think of plazas or parks, or, you know, in the United States, I think the some of the finest urban spaces are actually college campuses, which encourage walking. And there's so much more social interaction in those spaces, you know, than on a big traffic choked, highway or, you know, large roadway. So what it means, I think, you know, at the basic level is we'll have to figure out how to live a more powered down existence, but there's a lot of opportunity in that to reconnect with nature and reconnect with one another in ways that I think we've really been missing. And so, you know, I'm excited about that.
I mean, realistically, how fast do you think we can actually transition to, I suppose, a low carbon energy system?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I really don't like the idea of making predictions. I can't tell you like next Thursday or what, but I, you know, I
now,
think
the answer is now.
Right. I mean, it's urgent, right? I mean, the longer we wait and the more we push climate towards more and more degrees of warming, the worse it's going to be. And, you know, the greater the sea level rise, all of that. So it's completely urgent. I think it can be fast if we develop the political will to make it happen. Yeah. And, you know, so then you start thinking, well, what's going to cause that? And I think the most likely is crisis. You know, if we keep seeing this warming and sea level rise, you know, and we're going to accept the truth that this is happening and that we've got to change what we're doing. I think it can happen very quickly, but I'm scared that the, you know, that kind of, you know, it's more of a slow building problem right now, although it's building way faster than the scientists thought it was going to.
Yeah.
So that's makes it even scarier. But, you know, I definitely see in the United States much, much more political engagement and much more recognition that we are experiencing a shift with the climate. And I think once we get that critical mass, then you'll see the changes happening more quickly.
I was just going to ask you, actually, do you think we're already beginning to experience, I suppose, the ugly politics of scarcity, which I suppose will be the crisis that finally gets people to start acting, right?
Yeah, I do think we are experiencing that. I mean, I think that's largely what you've got in the United States. I mean, I said earlier that, you know, people who, you know, a lot of the people that voted in Trump, they have been struggling, you know,
yeah,
their wages have been going down. They, you know, people are out of work, you know, and they're looking for a change. And sometimes, you know, there's ugly politics that rears its head under those sorts of crisis situations. And so that, you know, that's really our, you know, that's our job, is to put better ideas out there so that, you know, when, as these crises unfold, people can do things like, hey, let's look at building stronger communities rather than, you know, becoming xenophobic and tearing down some other country halfway around the world. That let's look inward before we look outward. And yeah, so I see that as a really critical thing to be doing now. And, you know, I think that's part of the work that you're doing with your program. And so we've got to put ideas out there that help us find benign ways to transition to a powered down economy rather than, you know, like you say, a politics of scarcity and fighting over the last scraps. I mean, that's probably the worst way you could go.
But, you know, I think sadly that might be the way that it does go. I'm hoping it doesn't get to that. But I mean, looking at just the kind of, nonchalant regard that people have for the environment, it seems to be that might be the only thing that changes us, and it might be too late. I don't know. Sounds a bit
dire.
Yeah,
it's a risk. And yeah, I mean, you know, you don't want to, you know, just lose hope. And I mean, one of the things that I find, even if you believe that climate's going to spin out of control and we've lost all the habitat, and all, you know, even if you're really feeling that, I think the best we can do is make efforts to change, you know, whether that's in our own households or, you know, if you want to step up and do something in your community, or even looking at national and global scales. Even if you're not feeling hopeful that what you're doing is going to work, at least you will be congruent with your values. And I think that's a healthier place for people to be. And, you know, you might actually do some good and you might see some change as a result of taking action. So I would never, you know, even if it's getting dire, I think it's well worth trying to spread good ideas and change our behavior.
So I was actually watching a webinar that you were involved with. I think Richard Heinberg was also in it, and there were a couple of other people. And one of the questions that you raised was with regard to human overpopulation and our unsustainable reliance on fossil fuels. And you said these issues are theoretically solvable and they are also technologically solvable, but are they practically solvable?
Yeah, well, it's a hard question. I mean, you know, nobody wants to impinge on people's personal freedoms. But we know that, you know, right now, 7.5 billion people consuming the amount we're consuming is too much. Mm-hmm. And as people, you know, and a large chunk of those 7.5 billion are really just getting by, if at all, you know, they're struggling. And you start thinking about, well, how are we going to do this? I mean, we've clearly got to consume less. Mm-hmm. And part of that is we need a smaller population. But yeah, I think there are ways to get there. I mean, one of the things we've been talking about is in the United States and in a lot of other countries, there's been sort of a stigma with having smaller families. You know, either let's say you're a young adult and you decide you don't want children, or maybe a married couple decides we only want one child. You know, there's been sort of a, what are you, you got to have more, a pressure to have bigger families. And I think changing that culture is one way that we can help. You know, you don't want to shame people or make people feel bad about their decisions. And I think especially that one, you know, if you decide you want to have a smaller family, I think we should embrace and support that. And that could be built into some of the policies as well. In the U.S., there's a tax advantage to having more children and larger families. And really that should be reversed. So I think there are ways. And of course, the idea of making sure that our children have access to education, especially girls, you know, that's one of the best ways that leads to smaller families. And, you know, I don't know very many people who are against the idea of better education and, you know, making sure our children have access to it. So that's one that I think can gain a lot of support and really help. So there are possibilities for decreasing population that don't have anything to do with control and impingement and that sort of thing. So I'm hopeful that we can go that way too. But yeah, I mean you talk about feeling dire about climate or biodiversity loss, and you know, it's hard to think, wow, we might have 10 billion people all aspiring to, you know, the highest levels of consumption in the world. And, you know, what does that mean?
And it's funny that you mentioned that, because, I mean, personally, myself, I have one child, and that is my decision to stop there as well, because I can't imagine a future world that already is awaiting her. And I can't imagine bringing another child into this world. And I was reading some climate scientists who actually have children. They are so afraid, and they also are stopping at one and just saying that I cannot, you know, willfully bring a child into this world knowing what's going to happen.
Yeah, you know, that's such a personal decision, and it's it can be heart-rending. I mean, I'm in the same boat as you. I have one child and stopped there and won't have any more, and I feel good about that decision. I thought about it a lot, it's difficult. You know, there's a lot of people that feel like, oh, a bigger family is a happy family, or they came from a family that was larger. Yes. But I think these are the moral issues of our time, and we really can't afford anymore to not consider it and not think about it. So you know, I'm glad in a way that, you know, I'm not glad that you had to face that decision, but I'm glad that you considered it, thought about it, and came to a decision that's hopefully, you know, turns out to be a good one. And it, you know, it's sort of, hopefully that idea spreads, and that we, you know, sort of we band together and willingly end up with a movement towards a sustainably sized population.
So just going to economics, and do you think capitalism as we know it can survive in the era of climate change and energy transition?
Well, I don't think as we know it, it would survive. I mean, the problem really is the economic growth. Mm-hmm. And capitalism especially is geared for growth, but, you know, so are other types of economic systems. But, you know, the notion of economic growth is that you're increasing GDP exponentially. So that means every year you're consuming more stuff. I mean, GDP is just a measure of the value of goods and services produced in the economy. And essentially every nation in the world makes it the highest priority policy to keep increasing it. And as I said, exponentially, meaning that if you're looking at even something small like 2% growth, that means in 35 years, you've doubled the size of your economy. So, and that typically means that you're doubling the throughput of materials and energy in your economy, or you know, at least doing some multiple of what you were. So the idea that we can keep doing that on a finite planet just, you know, it doesn't square with logic, common sense. You know, there's a lot of people that think, well, technology can allow us to do that, but for how long? And I think that's basically a way of really not dealing with the underlying problem. So we've got to find a way to make a transition to an economy that actually works with stability rather than growth. And the way we've got our financial system set up right now, it's geared for growth, and it kind of breaks down when the economy stops growing. So that's one of the things we're definitely going to have to reform if we're going to figure out how to live sustainably.
And I mean, just to remind everybody, you are the lead author of Enough is Enough, a book on steady state economics. Maybe you could just remind people who've never heard of that concept what it's all about.
Yeah, a steady state economy really is about figuring out, it's an economy that doesn't have to grow. So you're really focusing on development instead, you know, increasing quality of life rather than increasing the scale of the economy. So there's a lot of things that you need to consider in it. You know, the very first is changing the goal. You know, the goal isn't always increasing GDP. It's stabilizing GDP at a level that can meet people's needs without undermining the life support systems of the planet. And then, you got to think about, if you're talking about limiting the throughput of energy and resources through the economy, then you really got to think about how you're dividing things up. You don't want to see what we've got now, which is, you know, a huge gap between the haves and the have-nots. You know, you've got so many people, you know, I shouldn't say so many, you have a few people like Donald Trump who have, you know, billions of dollars. Yeah. And then you've got, you know, the other 99% or even more, much more of the population that some of whom have not enough to get by on. So you really got to think about reducing that inequality, and then, you know, restructuring how businesses work, restructuring how the financial system works. It really is a total overhaul. But yeah, the idea of a steady state economy is one that functions well under conditions of stability rather than requiring us to always be consuming more.
But that's a tough mindset to change, right? I mean, because if you don't have growth, then what happens next is recession. And that's a word that's so scary for people. They just think, oh my God, my country is in trouble if I'm in a recession.
Yeah, but I do think things are changing. So, you know, it used to be that the idea of no growth was equated to no jobs.
Yeah.
And that link is really becoming tenuous. I mean, even in times of growth, we're still seeing job loss because of the automation. That's happening. So, you know, these are the sort of issues that we've got to wrestle with. But, you know, the idea is, yeah, we want to have meaningful jobs. You want people to, you know, people crave doing work that they care about and that helps them provide for their families and their communities. So, you know, we've got to take care of jobs. But, you know, what good is it to have jobs if we undermine, you know, our life support systems? You know, if our farms become unproductive because we've mined out the fertility of the soil, if our climate goes into, you know, some kind of, you know, warming that we can't undo, you know, it's, it's not going to help that, you know, that we had created some short-term jobs. So, so, you know, we've got to figure out how to have meaningful jobs that, you know, where we don't have to have a continuously increasing scale of the economy. But, you know, that also means we've got to stabilize population. So you're right. It's a huge mindset change and a lot of policy changes that we're going to need. And, you know, that's what we tried to lay out in the book, where what sorts of policies could help us get there.
So, I mean, what kind of like practical or concrete things can we do, particularly in this current economic and political climate, to kind of support the transition to a sustainable economy?
Yeah, I mean, you know, practically, I think you got to think of it in different scales. So at your household scale, you know, I think, well, you and I talked about one of them already, which is, you know, have the difficult conversation about how many children you want to have if you're of, you know, if you're of that age and you're thinking about family. You know, that's a huge life decision that, you know, will have implications on consumption within your family for, you know, for years. So that's a big one. You know, there are ways to think about how do I reduce my footprint? You can think about your travel habits, your electricity consumption habits, those sorts of your material goods consumption, your food consumption, all of that. You know, there are a lot of good resources out there about, you know, how to basically walk with a lighter footprint. And I think we can all find ways to improve and do that. One of the things that I've done is I live in a small co-housing eco village. We have about 70 people live here. There are 35 households, and you know, part of the values that we built into this little community is to to use less energy and less stuff. So you know, there's all kinds of neat little things like, you know, everybody doesn't have to own their own tools. You can just share one workshop, sort of thing. So I think there are a lot of ways, and, you know, I don't like to be prescriptive. I think everybody can look at their own situation and come up with some ways that, you know, that they can reduce their footprint. But then you can also think at the community scale and at the, you know, at the national scale. I mean, here at a national scale here, you see a lot of resistance. You know, there was the March for Science that happened on Earth Day, you know, and that was I got to participate in one of those in my town, and it was great to see, you know, people saying, hey, we are not going to just sit by and let the things we care about be undone. So, you know, I think there's that kind of thing, protest and activism that you can do at a bigger scale. And, you know, in our communities, I think just spreading the word. You know, the Think Resilience course that we're offering at the Post Carbon Institute, you can do it as a self-directed course where you can just go through the videos. But, you know, we're working on making it a discussion course where somebody could gather, you know, 8 or 10 friends and over the course of a few weeks go through the videos and have some, you know, some really in-depth conversations about how do we build resilience into our communities. And then, you know, you can go out and actually start undertaking projects, you know, maybe making your community more bicycle friendly, or maybe, you know, starting a farmer's market or community supported agriculture, all kinds of great ways in a community to figure out how to live more sustainably.
Oh, even simple things like, you know, starting your own little community recycling program.
Yeah.
Selling pre-loved goods and things like that so that there's no waste, and trying to, I suppose, aim towards a zero waste lifestyle. That's something that's quite popular these days.
and you know, I think part of what we often overlook, some people, that's a big pain, or I don't want to, but really what you end up doing is building community. You end up, you know, having this friendly network, and, you know, it can be, I think, a really healthy way to connect with one another and to feel good about taking action in a time when action is needed.
Okay, Rob, just to conclude then, what are your suggestions or recommendations for some good reading material, actually, to kind of get us on board and to head towards this carbon-free future, I suppose?
Yeah, well, you know, there are two books that we're about to put out the Community Resilience Reader, and it's not available yet. So it's coming out, I believe, towards the end of September. So I definitely recommend that. But prior to that, Post Carbon Institute had published the Post Carbon Reader, and that's a series of essays on, on this transition, both on the crisis side and the solution side. So that, I highly recommend that as well. And if you look at Richard Heinberg, as an author, you'll find he's written 13 books on topics all related to sustainability and the post-carbon economy. And so, yeah, I recommend all of them. One of them is, one of the more recent ones is Our Renewable Future, that really takes a very realistic look and analysis of what are our options for making the transition to a renewable energy economy. And, you know, it's not as rosy as a lot of the analysts out there, but, I think it's far more realistic about not making assumptions on the technological front. So all really good reads. And, of course, if you're interested in the steady state economy, I think my book Enough is Enough that I wrote with Dan O'Neill is an easy one to read. And if you want to go into more depth there, look at the work by Herman Daly, D-A-L-Y. He's done so much to promote sustainable economics.
Okay, thank you so much, Rob.
Yeah, thanks, Julia. It's always a pleasure.
I've been speaking today to Rob Dietz. He is the program director at the Post Carbon Institute, and he was also the lead author of Enough is Enough, a book on steady state economics. And we were discussing, among many other things, how to transition to a post-carbon world. If you'd like to find out more about the Post Carbon Institute, you can visit postcarbon.org. This has been Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.